a bail application, and I think that might have a lot of Nance's pertinent info on it. I handed her the phone. I just don't know how to get at it. She shook her head and brought the photo onto the screen. You are so helpless. She stared at it and began reading the information. Oh, we can find him with all of this. As she worked, I glanced around Nutter's office, taking in the photos and plaques that you accumulate over decades in law enforcement, and thought about how the stuff on his walls looked a lot like the stuff on mine, although a lot of mine was left over from Lucian Connolly. Okay, nothing till 97, when he was charged by a federal grand jury in California for conspiring to defraud the IRS and tax evasion that had to do with money owed for the two previous years. His wife was also charged.
He said they were divorced, and she'd gotten three houses out of him.
Vic continued reading from the computer screen. I can see how there was trouble in paradise. He sold a business in California, then didn't report it, and then tried to conceal the 2 years of monetary installments by filing false tax returns. She looked up at me. It looks like he might have gotten his daughter to do it, too.
Uh-oh.
And then the whole happy family concealed the assets by opening a foreign bank account in a Caribbean island using purported trusts. Over the next year or so, he deposited more than $6 million into the account, but then they got divorced, and I'm betting she dropped a dime on his ass. I rested my face in my hands.
Then what?
He sold his business, probably in an attempt to pay off some of the taxes and accrued penalties. She looked up. I mean, this guy was going to the Big Stony Lonesome, Club Fed. Leaving my face in my hands, I spoke through my fingers. What was the name of his business? She scanned the screen. Doesn't say.
Which California grand jury address?
Oakland.
Near Silicon Valley? She nodded and took in a deep breath.
Home of Special Materials, who first came up with the formula for this particular ASP.
Then what?
Her tarnished gold eyes went back to the screen. The next mention is when he wired the remainder of the proceeds to a law firm in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. But then he instructed them to wire $3.7 million to an account in, of all places, she looked at me, Scottsdale, Arizona.
Home of Dust Devil Development, and the dumpster where Titchener was found the year before.
Holy shit.
It's all circumstantial.
Are you fucking kidding?
Do me a favor. I'm curious about the Detroit connection, so type his name in along with Detroit and see what comes up.
Nothing. No. Wait. There's a picture of him, much younger, winning some kind of prize or award as an alumnus of the University of Michigan back in the 70s. She turned the screen so that I could see. Isn't that him?
Yep. Put in automobile industry.
She tapped a few more keys. Here he is again. He worked for GM for most of his early career.
And was involved in engine and acoustical tile development? She nodded.
Yeah, and exhaust systems.
Stainbrook mentioned that the first time they stumbled across this stuff was when they were developing polymer exhaust valves that were supposed to be as strong as steel.
Shit. I'm betting he was in on developing it first.
Yep, or at least got it started.
She slumped back in Nutter's chair. Why wouldn't you just patent this stuff and sell it to the government for bags of money? I mean, the CIA wanted it.
Just from the small amount we've gleaned from this, I don't think Nance has a very good opinion of the federal government, especially as a business partner.
So he gets Titchener to advance the polymer further, and then gets rid of him when he hands it over to research and development.
Chorus.
And then when he's got a workable material, he gets rid of him.
Or somebody does.
Come on, Walt, the guy is Professor Moriarty. He's leaving bodies around like the Black Plague.
Well, by getting in bed with the trade train nomads via Del Shea and Bodaway, he's certainly been introduced to the criminal element.
Introduced?
She touched up the lipstick at the corner of her perfect mouth with the tip of a pinky and stared at the computer screen.
Hell, they're fucking engaged. So, what have we got?
My undersheriff leaned against the front counter of the office, the three of us enjoying the brief lull.
Well, it's complex.
Corbin nodded and chewed his sandwich.
I figured.
I leaned on the other side of the patrolman and came clean. It's looking more and more like Nutter's friend, Bob Nance, They'd be involved in all of this.
Nance involved with Kiddo?
I think it's all connected to the investigation the ATF has been working on and why Agent Post was murdered.
What's the deal?
Plastic guns, Vic went on to explain, adding Nance's industrial background as the last piece of the puzzle. But now we have to come up with some kind of concrete evidence that connects Kiddo to Nance. Henry and I did a little snooping in Billy V's shop, but there was nothing advanced enough to indicate that he was doing anything out of the ordinary, other than modifying bikes to carry either samples of the plastic or prototypes of the guns themselves. I stepped away from the counter and turned to look at Corbin. Does Nance have any other properties around here where they might have a facility large enough to produce the ASPs?
Having lost his appetite, he set his sandwich down. I have no idea.
I assume we'd have to go down to Sundance to go through the records and find out where all his real estate holdings are.
Yeah, I guess.
He thought about it.
Wait, you're looking for some sort of connection between Kiddo and Nance, right?
Yep.
Well, Eddie worked for Kiddo for about 2 years before Billy V fired him last winter.
Vic was incredulous.
Our Eddie? The drunk Viking?
Yeah.
Go get him.
We could hear Doherty's keys jangling as he disappeared into the back holding cells where the lawless awaited transport to the Crook County Jail in Sundance. Vic walked over with her head down, speaking softly as she chewed a nail.
I am having trouble thinking of a less reliable informant.
Me too. Doherty returned with Eddie and sat him on a chair, his Viking helmet a little askew. It looked like Corbin had woken him up. A little goggle-eyed, he glanced at my undersheriff.
Is she going to show me her tits?
Probably not. I placed my hands on my knees and bent down to look him in the eyes.
Hey, Eddie.
Yeah?
You worked for Billy V. Kiddo for a few years, right?
Yeah?
He belched.
He's a prick.
I glanced at the others. Yep, we kind of got that.
Still quite drunk, his eyes wobbled around the room.
Fired me, said I didn't know shit. I told him,
Eddie. I reached out and took his chin to try to hold his attention. Do you remember if Kiddo had another shop that he worked in?
Prick.
The chop shop, Billy's place, was there another one?
No.
You sure?
Yeah.
What about a guy by the name of Bob Nance? Did Billy V ever have any dealings with Nance?
The rich prick?
I tried to keep from laughing.
Could be. Asshole lives on a golf course. As a jet that we went for a ride in, went all the way to Daytona. Fast, man.
So what did Kiddo do with Nance?
Stuff, man. He did stuff.
I grabbed his chin again. Did Billy V work for Nance? And if he did, where? Did you ever go to his house? He pulled loose and flapped his hands in an attempt to keep mine away.
Yeah, man, I did a couple of times, and then we went to that bunker thing of his.
I stood, glancing at the others and then back down at him.
What bunker thing?
The hut, man. The half-round thing that sticks up out of the ground.
A Quonset hut?
Yeah, I mean, that's what it started as.
Where? He threw a thumb over his shoulder, gesturing toward who knows where.
On that road.
What road? He gestured in another direction this time.
To the airport road.
In Rapid City?
No, man, here.
I turned to look at Doherty. Hewlett, with a population of under 400 people, has an airport? It's the only airport in Crook County. Took 10 years to get it built. Driving past the clubhouse, we headed south along the ridge where Vic had won the skeet event. The only way to get to the airport is this road through the golf course?
Yeah.
Convenient for Nance. Vic slowed the Challenger and stopped at the precipice where we could see the 5,500-foot runway angling southwest to our right about a mile. Corbin pointed toward a branch road that led north around a ridge. That's the only other road, so it must be up there. Vic, pocket that pull-off and we'll hike. I don't see any reason to advertise. She did as I said, and as we all piled out, I glanced at Doherty. You have any binoculars with you? He reached into a shooting bag and produced a pair in a plastic case. Believe it or not, I use them for bird watching. Vic struck out in front.
I believe you.
We weaved our way through the pines that gave the Black Hills their name, and up a wash where the hillside must have collapsed after the road had been put in.
There was some brush at the top and a lot more trees, so we could move without being seen toward the southern point of the high ground. When we got there, I kneeled down and studied the small box canyon below. It was a relatively impossible sight to sneak up on, with rock walls on three sides, and if I were a betting man, I would have guessed that the canyon had started out shallow but had at one point been excavated and used as a quarry, the walls now creeping up quickly around the structure. If Nance was looking to build an impregnable fortress, he could have done worse. The bunker that Eddie the Viking had made reference to was about halfway up, and if it had started as a Quonset hut, it had evolved from there. The building was a concrete fortress, with no windows and a razor wire perimeter, and there were concrete vehicle blockades leading toward the entrance down by the main road. Hell. Dougherty handed me the binoculars, and I laid down on the edge to take a closer look. There were security guards in black polo shirts near the entrance, and down by the gate, including Frick and Frack, the same men I'd seen at Nance's house and the shooting event. There were a couple of black jeeps parked close to the building, black being the new black, but nothing else out in the open. So, what could Nance be doing down there that's so important that he has to have armed guards around the place? Corbin was the first to respond. Something worth a lot of money. Vic was more succinct. Something illegal. Tired of resting my weight on my elbows, I rolled over onto my back and handed the binoculars to my undersheriff. It's the Alamo. She held the glasses up to her eyes and kept them there for a long look. Then, let's go get a couple hundred thousand Mexicans and take 'em. Now, this is where we hand a stick off to Stainbrook and the ATF. They're set up for this kind of foolishness. We'll head back into town and tell them to get a task force out here to shut down Nance and Kero's operation. Vic continued to focus the binoculars on the compound below.
I'd say just Nance's operation, because it sure looks to me like they're taking Billy the Kiddo for a proverbial ride.
I rolled back over. What? She handed the binoculars back to me.
Isn't that shit for brains getting loaded into one of the jeeps?
I focused in, and sure enough, Frick was stuffing the Hollywood biker into the passenger seat of one of the Wranglers as Frack climbed in the back. Could you see if Kiddo was handcuffed?
Yeah, he was.
I watched as they pulled out, were let through the gate, and then headed toward the main road. I turned to Dougherty. Where do you think they're going?
This way, I'd imagine. The only thing in the other direction is the airport.
We stood and hustled back toward the Dodge.
You think they're going to fly him out of here?
If he's lucky.
When we got back to Vic's rental, you could clearly see down the hill, and there was no Jeep Wrangler coming our way.
They must be going to the airport. Corbin opened the door and tossed his bag in the back. Nance has a jet, one of those twin-engine Cessnas, so we'd better hustle if we're going to catch them.
Vic was already in the driver's seat, and I threw myself in the nick of time, the Dodge roaring sideways as we shot by the precipice and down the long slope. Slow down when you go past the cutoff. We don't want to draw their attention when we go by.
Dougherty hung between the bucket seats. The cutoff to the bunker is past the airport road, so just slow down when you get there. You can't see the hangars in the bunker, either. It's too far up the canyon.
We slowly turned at the airport and drove down into the parking lot. I drew my .45 as we did a quick circle around the half-dozen buildings, still seeing no jeep.
You think they're inside one of the hangars?
Not with the kind of aircraft you described. They would have to have that thing out here and warming up with a crew. I glanced at the gravel road that ran alongside the runway. Where does that road go? He looked through the windshield past us.
There are a few hay fields down that way and some dirt roads that peer out into the forest before you get over to 24 or 183.
Vic turned to look at him.
So there's nothing down there?
Not really. She gunned the Challenger and laid a 20-foot black strip on the tarmac.
They're going to kill him.
We swung around another corner as Vic leveled out the Dodge and lit up all the cylinders, bringing the Hemi online like an orange javelin. Dougherty flew across the back seat and crashed into the other side.
I'd put my seatbelt on if I were you, Troop.
The big straightaway along the airport gave us the advantage by allowing the muscle car to flex and catch up with the cloud of dust roiling from behind what we assumed was the jeep.
I sure am going to be disappointed if we're following some rancher on his tractor.
She put her foot even farther into the Dodge's accelerator.
I'll tell you here in a second.
There was another turn, and I had to admire the way she flat-tracked the Challenger, throwing it into the gravel curve and keeping her foot in it the whole way as she focused on her prey.
Oh, you are mine, chicken shit. The vehicle ahead had followed the road to the left and quickly passed over an elevated bridge where I could see that it was indeed the Wrangler.
It's them. Vic sawed the wheel and we shot off the road into the hay pasture, taking a more direct route to the bridge.
Got it.
Even though we were pounding the undercarriage of the low-slung muscle car, we made time, but I wasn't sure what was going to happen when we attempted to get back on the elevated gravel road, or worse yet, the bridge. We screamed along, the bridge appearing to be approaching at an alarming rate. If we missed it, we would most certainly end up crashing into the guardrail buttresses or flying into the creek. I braced a hand against the dash. Vic!
Got it!
The Dodge flew up the embankment, skipped the edge, and slamming onto the road's uneven surface, slid completely sideways, the buttress of the bridge looking more and more like a gigantic, swinging cudgel.
Vic! Got it!
From the back, Corbin's voice sounded surprisingly conversational.
We are all going to die.
Whipping the wheel to the right, she nosed the hood of the car forward into the narrow aperture. We all held our breath as the tires pulled free, but the car met the road and blistered the wood planks, soared over the downgrade, and blew into the 100 feet of remaining gravel road before thundering over a cattle guard into an expanse of hayfield still scattered with 1,000-pound square bales. The Wrangler, traveling at a slightly more sedate pace, was running along to our right. Frick turned and looked at us as if we were crazy.
I think we've caught up to them.
The jeep swerved, and one of the hay bales, very green with alfalfa, shot between us. On the other side, we regained sight of each other, and I could see Frick had his window down and was giving us a questioning look. Hoping to avoid anything dramatic, I pulled my badge wallet from my pocket and flashed it at him about the time that Vic swerved to miss another bale. My hopes of keeping things civil were dashed as the back window on the jeep began rolling down, and I could see Frack brandishing some sort of automatic machine pistol. I gave it one last try, yelling over the noise of the two engines, "Absaroka Sheriff's Department, pull over!" Frick ignored me, and Frack pointed the pistol at us.
"Vic, got it!"
She locked up the brakes on the car and then swung hard, careening behind the Wrangler and then gunning it and coming up on the other side. Corbin's voice rose from the back.
"Won't the door stop bullets?"
"No, they won't. Even a .22 will go through most modern car doors, and maybe through the other side as well. Roll your window down. It'll give you another layer of insulation if it makes you feel better."
"The window will stop a bullet?
Can't hurt." Thank goodness the hayfield was relatively smooth from years of plowing, and thank more goodness it had just been swathed so that Vic could at least see where the really rough patches were. She swerved around another bale and angled toward the jeep as he attempted to steer clear of her. I could see that Billy Thee was handcuffed to the dash and didn't look too comfortable with the situation. It was about then that the rear window on the other side of the jeep began rolling down, and the automatic pistol made another appearance.
"I don't think they want to talk."
She sliced around another bale and came in hard this time, clipping the back quarter of the jeep, but Frick corrected and continued on. Dougherty swung up between the seats again.
"Do you want me to shoot?"
Vic and I both answered as one. "Just put your seatbelt on." Pulling to one side, I slid my Colt from the holster just as Vic handed me her Glock.
"Shoot 'em!"
"I'm going to give them one more opportunity to stop."
"You're going to get us killed."
She slid in behind the jeep as Frick began a slow turn to the left in an attempt to stay in the field.
"Hopefully Frack won't shoot out of the back."
Watching Frick slalom through the bales, Vic stayed close but then swung out again, positioning us on the left as I hung my badge out for them to see.
"Absaroka County Sheriff, stop the vehicle now!"
We hit some bumps, and there was some noise, but it was only when I saw the barrel of the automatic smoking that I realized that Frack had fired. I glanced into the rear and could see that Corbin's eyes were wide as he looked at the holes punched in the interior panels of the car.
"Are you hit?" "No, and I'd just as soon not be."
Vic swerved around another bale, and I turned to see that Frack was aiming at us again. I extended both of my arms, a weapon in each hand, aiming low at the jeep's tires, and began pulling the triggers until there was nothing left. In a second, I had blown out both tires, but the Wrangler was veering toward us now, and I could see Frick lowering his window, both men attempting to take careful aim at me. Grabbing the extra magazines from my belt, I dropped the empty and jammed the fresh rounds into my Colt as Vic locked up the brakes, using another bale for cover and swinging behind the still-speeding jeep.
"Okay, I'm ready to shoot them now." "About time."
She turned the leather-clad wheel and we fainted to the right, getting the backseat gunner to move to the other side, but then swung the Dodge's 700 horses back up on the driver's side. We overshot a bit, but by the time we drew even, I had the .45 fully extended and aimed directly at the driver's head, just hoping I didn't miss and hit Billy V. As is usually the case, that split-second hesitation cost me. There was a swale in the field, and both vehicles were thrown to the right, causing me to lose my position in the seat and hit my face on the door. I could feel the blood spilling from my nose as I clambered back up and swiped at my face in an attempt to clear my eyes. Once I did, I could see both Frick and Frack extending their pistols and smiling. It was about then that they ran head-on into one of the 1,000-pound bales.
Chapter 15. That's something you don't see every day. We pulled up beside the jeep. The driver had buried its front into the bale, and its rear end was now sticking up off the ground at about a 30-degree angle. Keeping my sidearm on the door, I tossed Vic hers, and she went around to the other side, with Corbin following her with his own drawn. You two get Frick and Frack, and I'll get Kiddo. The body of the Wrangler was crumpled and had impinged the door, but I pulled the handle and bent the door back on its hinges as the airbags deflated. Kiddo was slumped in his seat, handcuffed to it with the chain running through the chicken bar. I felt for a pulse, and it was strong, so he wasn't dead. He's out cold. Vic had opened the other side, and unceremoniously pulled the driver out, allowing him to sag onto the ground. This one's alive, barely, but alive. Reaching up, I pried open the rear door and stepped aside as Frack tumbled out. I went through the motions, flipped him over, and took the machine gun, but could plainly see that he'd shot himself a number of times on impact. This one's dead, a bunch of times over. I went back to the front, adjusted Billy V's seat, slipped off the safety belt, and pushed him back. Check the driver for cuff keys, would you? Corbin was already on it and patted the now moaning Frick as Vic collected weapons. Dougherty brought the keys around, and I uncuffed Kiddo, pulled him from the vehicle, and placed him on my shoulder. I carried him around and laid him on the trunk lid of the Dodge, where I noticed he'd pissed himself. Corbin looked around my shoulder. Are you sure he's alive? He's breathing. I glanced over at Vic, who was kneeling by Frick. Can he talk? She reached down and none too gently smacked his face. Hey, asshole, can you talk? His face rolled a little to the side, and then he sputtered and raised a hand, which Vic immediately grabbed and placed under her knee. I said talk, not move. He cried out, and she shook her head. Stop being a pussy. He gargled something about his knee killing him, and it was possible that he had a point, in that it was bleeding and had already swollen to the size of a cantaloupe, even with the constriction of his BDU pants. My undersheriff kneeled a little more pointedly on his arm. Talk, asshole! My experience with types like you is that your mouths always work. I moved in, getting the wayward attention of the driver. His eyes stated on mine. How you doing, Mr. Frick? He gasped. How the hell do you think I'm doing? I studied his knee, broken nose, sloped collarbone, and what looked to be a couple of broken fingers on his other hand. Well, you look like shit. We need medical attention. I glanced through the open doors of the jeep at the body on the other side. We? Nope, I don't think so. Your buddy's dead as Kelsey's nuts. Must have shot himself about 9 times. And I think your prisoner just has a case of the vapors. I studied him. Where were you headed?
Lawyer.
I glanced around. I don't think you're going to find one out here. He yelled it this time. I want a lawyer, and I want answers. Maybe we can work out a trade. Spitting the words, he repeated himself. Lawyer. Vic picked up the bloody machine pistol from the ground, where I had put it down in order to get Kiddo out of the vehicle, and sprayed the fender of the Wrangler with a frightening series of shots, then carefully placed the muzzle close to the guy's eye.
You feel the heat from that, shithead? Try and imagine how hot it'll be at over 1,500 feet per second when I pull the trigger again.
Frick still said nothing, choosing instead to exhale, blowing the coagulated blood from his nose. Vic obliged him by closing up one of the nostrils with the automatic, the heat of the muzzle sizzling the blood before he could turn his head away.
I'm betting there's another 20 rounds in this thing that I can use to fill up that empty head of yours if you don't start talking.
I'm not incriminating myself, he closed his eyes and swallowed. But, what do you want to know? I mean, off the record. I glanced back toward the municipal airport. Somebody taking an early flight?
Yeah.
Were you guys supposed to join the bunker bunch on board? He said nothing until Vic tapped his temple with the Zig Sauer.
Maybe, all right?
How long before they start figuring out something went wrong? He thought about it.
The head guy is making financial arrangements, so they can't get out of here till he gets that stuff done, but it won't be long.
He winced.
Look, my fucking knee is killing me.
Vic moved and again reminded him about the 9mm. How fortified is the bunker? He snorted.
Forget it, Andy Griffith. You'll never get in there.
I nodded. These guys, do they have a stake or are they just hired?
Hired, but they're good.
I looked down at him and smiled.
As good as you?
I made Frick ride in the trunk with the dead frack, mostly because there wasn't a lot of room, but also because I thought he needed a lesson in humility. We followed another series of hayfields, reconnected with the gravel road that led around the airport, and swung back north to where we joined Route 209 and finally 24, thereby getting back into Hewlett without having to go near the bunker and raising suspicions. Vic parked the Dodge at the police station, and we tried not to draw too much attention to ourselves as we carried the bodies into the office, putting Frick in the holding cell.
What in the hell?
Chief Nutter held the door as we returned, with Billy V draped between Corbin and me, finally placing him in the office chair. Call in the EMTs down the street for the one in the cell, and they can take the dead one, too. I turned to Vic. Grab one of those handheld radios, get back on that ridge, and keep an eye on them. Give us a call if anybody moves, okay? She grabbed a radio and, with an extended burnout from the parking lot, was gone. Nutter placed his hands on his knees and studied Kiddo's still unconscious face.
This one alive?
Enough to piss himself. I tapped the face of the star of Chopper off with the back of my hand. I would have figured he'd been awake by now, but I guess not. Nutter disappeared into the back and came out with a couple of paper tabs in one hand. Ammonium carbonate?